even Maharaji said, if you're doing this seva, it's not your energy. It's not even your own will anymore. The whole thing is working through you, right? So when you talk to people who are committed in this way, their work is their seva. It carries them. It does them, you know. They don't do it. It does them, you know what I mean?
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Searching for Godcast. This is Deki and Baba Ananda. We're exploring some of our shared language for our understanding of God. Our aim is to demystify some of the concepts in the conversation and to provide a catalyst for our listeners to put words to their own experiences. This podcast is an act of service to Neem Karoli Baba and anyone out there who is lonely, confused, excited, or curious.
Hello, beloveds. This is Baba Ananda. Thank you for joining us in this inaugural episode where we are just beginning to unpack some of the interpretations and words used around these lofty ideas. This podcast is in part an ongoing conversation between friends. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Searching for Godcast. I'm here with my friend Ananda. And you taught me a word this week, Leela. Would you like to share it with us?
Leela. If you look up Leela, like if you look up Leela online, it'll say something like divine play, right? What we have managed to do, you know, we've westernized a lot of these words. And Leela, to me, is kind of that roundabout way, that roundabout thing that you go through from point A to point B. That's not always a direct route, right?
Yeah.
So my simple answer is, it's like if you're looking for your keys, right? You have your keys on your dresser. It's where you always put them in the same spot. And you can't find your keys.
Mm-hmm.
So you go on this mad hunt.
You're looking everywhere.
Everywhere.
You're looking in the freezer.
Yeah, exactly. Places, there's no way your keys would be there. You're looking in old shorts from the summer or like a jacket from last winter or whatever. So you're going over old paths. Maybe you find a $100 bill in a pocket of that jacket, right? That you took to the ski valley or something like that. And you're like, whoa, I got this $100 bill. How cool is that? And then you go back to where you thought your keys were and there they were all along, right?
The whole time.
That's a really simplified way of talking about it, right? So
yeah.
In this tradition that we're talking about, the Hindu tradition, in the Ram, the Ram Leela, Ram the story Leela. Of Ram in the Mahabharata, is called a Leela because it's this roundabout story of all these things that have to happen in order for this destiny to be fulfilled. So we use it to talk about Maharaji, we use it to talk about our guru in that he teaches these, he gives us these lessons through leelas. And a leela is almost freaking like anything that happens to you. At this point, all of the things that happen to me, I feel like are leelas one way or another. Right?
I've used it 100 times this week.
Right? Like how? Like what do you mean? What does it mean to you?
Oof, okay. The perfect example of a leela, I think, I just met this wonderful dog, Baloo, and I've been thinking of my dog, George, at home. A friend and I were trying to make Christmas ornaments one year, you know, and we decided to go to the Dollar General, go down the road. It was randomly closed. We come back and there's this beautiful dog just weaving in and out of traffic. I pull over on the side of the road. I open my door. I'm like, dude, get in. We had clearly made a pact in a past life to meet at that exact time and moment because he jumped right in like, dude, I was waiting for you. He's a bodhisattva. And I can't believe I met him that way because I was taking some sort of trip down the road for nothing, you know? And I feel like there have been all these little moments this week. It's my first week at the Neem Karoli Baba Ashram in Taos. And yeah, just like coming to things, even just, you know, I thought I was coming here to quit smoking cigarettes and I ended up in the smoker's pit with Ananda on this podcast.
That's another podcast. Okay.
Leela.
All right. So, I mean, like I said, that's a very oversimplified way to talk about it. But you know, a lot of people, I think, those of us, especially kind of where we're at right now, we find ourselves there through a series of, you know, maybe unfortunate events or a roundabout way of things transpiring to get us to this point of grace, right? To this connection, sort of to this reconnection with God, which is, you know, the name of the podcast, the Searching for Godcast.
We should probably jump into that for a second. What do you mean when you say God?
Well, this is kind of really, you know, not only is it tricky ground, but I mean, it can be very really quite simple, but people have a lot of hangups around the word God, right?
Yeah.
Myself included.
Whole wars have been fought.
So I would say the first thing that I think of is God does not mean old white haired guy in the sky, right? There are a lot of progressive contemporary Christian religions specifically who have adopted this non-binary concept of God. Like, we don't know. It's unknowable. It's bigger than we can obviously imagine. Mm-hmm. So to assign a gender is pretty ridiculous. But like we were saying earlier, one of the things I resonate, I'm not a Hindu, but one of the things I resonate with about Hinduism is they're like, there's no way you can define God in any singular capacity. So there has to be at least 1,008 deities, 1,008 aspects of each deity. The list goes on and on and on and on, right? Mm-hmm. If you're going to describe the personality of God, then at least, the very least you're doing is describing the entirety of the human existence. So,
beyond the human existence.
Right, exactly.
The
entire, that's what I'm saying, at least.
Animated that. Course of the universe.
So then God, you know, defined in different religious philosophies, mm-hmm. The eminence of all creation, or this sort of combined balance of the universe, you know, this order in the chaos, you know, and a lot of great thinkers and philosophers and, you know, mathematicians and scientists have come to these universal concepts of God. And one of the things that I really have gotten into, I mean, getting into Maharaji, you know, one of the names of the, like, one of the books that I want to write is How My Hindu Guru Got Me to Love Jesus.
Oh, beautiful.
And Other Stories to Offend Everyone. no, I forgot what the hell I was talking about. So, you know, these ideas of God, like, so multifaceted, it can't be described in any kind of singular concept or idea, right? Mm-hmm. So if you believe in a consciousness behind the universe, or if you believe in any kind of a, like I said, a order in the chaos.
A purposeful, like, source energy.
I like that. Like intentional, mm-hmm. like something with, there's some intention behind it. Or, you know, as Einstein said, God does not play dice with the universe. That to me means that there's some sort of a plan. Right? That to me means that there's some sort of a plan, that that something is happening and we're somehow a part of it. Mm. There's this incredible astrophysicist that I've been seeing all over YouTube, and I forget his name right now. He's an atheist, but he's still talking about what if, you know, this Fermi paradox, the idea that if there was life, any kind of life out in the universe, it would have found us by now. Or it's by the time you reach that level, you don't want to
colonize.
You burned
yourselves out,
yeah, you
or
don't,
something.
Or you
yeah.
don't want to. You don't want to go and explore because you're content where you are.
Yeah.
Then, if it's possible that we're the only expression, the only conscious expression of the universe, then that's exactly what we are. Is we are the universe experiencing itself, right? Mm. So, if you can kind of grok all that, if you can get your head around all that, then the idea of God to me isn't necessarily about a creator or someone standing there pulling strings and taking care of business, more of an overall rolling kind of concept, right? So which takes mm-hmm. us back to the idea of Leela, like that Leelas are this rolling out of circumstances or this rolling out of energies that needs to transpire for one thing to lead to another.
Yes.
Right. And one of my favorite things about Leela is if you are intended for this thing, you could run from it. You could literally go in the opposite direction from it. I know because I have.
Yeah.
And you end up where you're supposed to be. It's out of your control.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's this idea of tempting fate, right? What the Bible talks about with Jesus, the 40 days that he was tempted by Satan. And Satan says, jump off the mountain because you're protected by angels. And he said, not if I do it on purpose. Right?
It's attachment and aversion. Aversion, something still got you. You're running from something. You're still directing all of the energy of attention and love right at it.
Even if you're running from it.
Yeah.
Right? That's the whole thing, right? So you could possibly get away with that for a while. But
even trying to ignore it, it's still got you. It's still living in your
head. The more
head
you
rent-free.
Ignore it, the bigger it comes up, right?
Yeah.
So that gives us an idea of Leela, right? And I can talk about my own life on and on and on in terms of how Leela, and it's also like a ripple, right? So if something's going on for you, like we could go a little deeper with it. Say you're having issues with your car, right?
Oh, let's say.
and you happen upon somebody who can fix your particular issue who also needs $60,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God, I'll gladly give you $60 to fix my thing. And then in the process of meeting this person, some other connection happens or you realize it's your long lost cousin, you know, or whatever. I mean, you know
sure.
what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So that idea of Leela. And then if you can get behind that, then you can start to look into these ideas of what other people might call the miraculous, right? So things then start happening with a particular order. There's no coincidence, right? Nothing happens by, there's no accidents. There's no coincidence. There's like an order in the chaos that something is always, doesn't mean that it's always good. It doesn't mean it goes down easy.
It doesn't mean you can always distill that order perfectly. Sometimes things just sneak up on you.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. But it does, the idea being that it is tilting towards, you know, even what Martin Luther King Jr. said, the universe or, you know,
tilts towards justice.
Exactly. So if you can take that and think about it in terms of where we're going as a species and what we're, you know, the Leela is constantly, we're all stumbling towards, you know, Jerusalem, stumbling towards Bethlehem, however that goes. So
it's incredible. Leela.
That's Leela.
Darshan, that's another word that's been coming up a lot this week. Would you like to share about it?
Well, why don't you tell me what Darshan means to you?
I learned maybe just 5 minutes ago practicing for this recording. It's Hindi. to take sight.
Okay.
Of a saint or an emanation of God in the flesh, maybe.
Right.
I guess this is one that I don't know if I have a good textbook definition of it, but uh-huh. I have an experience of it.
Uh-huh.
As you well know, just over 10 years ago now, I was in a coma for quite some time. I saw things that I couldn't explain. It's what put me here today. I mean, everything put me here today. That's Leela. But Darshan, we're on Darshan. And I can't really explain exactly what I saw.
Was it a feeling?
Oh.
I mean, obviously.
All of the feelings.
Of
every possible iteration of my life, every past life, every future life, every possibility until it culminated in this one perfect moment of light, of awareness, of presence, of love. And that is the moment that I saw God for the first time, or at least the first time that I got to call it that. And I woke up and I had questions. And I think Darshan leads you to questions.
And,
you know, if people think of it as an answer, this is the thing. This is the moment, the culmination. It's not. It is the beginning of the search.
Wow.
Searching for God. Cast.
Wow. I would have to say that as much as I love that, in the lingo, like the The Darshan is obviously, you're absolutely correct. Yes, and. Yes, and. Yes, and.
Yes, it is, and not also, quite.
Well, no, not even not quite. Totally on point. Totally on point. Yes, and. For reals, 100%. Because it is also the culmination. You know, like, mm-hmm. So it's to take sight. But meaning, like I said, we've sort of westernized this term. We've turned it into more of like a spiritual hit or a psychic hit or some kind of a boom that you feel through experiencing the grace of whatever it is we're doing, the grace of God, the grace of the guru, whatever.
So it's an original sense. Tell me more.
Well, so let's say real quick, textbook definition is to actually see the saint.
Yeah.
You know, or in the mystical circumstances, to see an apparition of the deity, or to see our Hanumanji at the temple, to see his tail swish or his head.
Oh, he blinked.
Move.
Absolutely.
I know you were telling me that. So that is closer to the sort of OG definition.
Okay.
Of Darshan. But for us, so I experienced Darshan the first time probably as a young lad in a Christian church when the music was really pumping and the Psalms somehow meant something to me. And, you know, I went to a mega church as a kid. There's a reason why 3,000 people are packed in this building listening to some dude scream about Jesus. There's a reason why that's happening. Like that, there's something to that. I'm not saying it's legitimate at the end of the day, but what I am saying is that there is something going on that has an impact on people.
Yes, something that draws you in.
Right? So we can talk about it being manipulative, right? So, but let's take that out of the equation right now, because I'm talking about mega churches and me having experience as a little kid, right? But in that moment, what's happening is this rush, some sort of feeling, something that's bigger than the moment, mm-hmm. right? And then I went on to run off with the Grateful Dead for a few years when I was 18 years old with Jerry Garcia, like that Grateful Dead. Something happening there in a similar capacity that could take you and lift you out of your circumstances. Mm-hmm. It could move what I now call karma, like karma for you, right? Karma is another word we should talk about defining, because Westerners get that one wrong all the time.
Mm.
If you can remember to bring me back to that, I'll talk about it again in a second.
I'll get you.
But the idea being, and I literally have said Jerry Garcia was my first guru because he moved karma for me. So he changed my circumstances.
Yes.
by taking time out of my life, to taking steps to pursue this vibe, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking still like deadheadism, but still going out of my way to pursue this thing and to find more than I ever could have possibly imagined. Like that to me is what I later, because I wasn't into gurus and I wasn't into religious teachers because I had this whole Christian upbringing that I eventually revolted from.
Yeah.
Beyond disillusioned, disenfranchised. Wasn't working. They couldn't answer my questions. They said, aren't you reading your own book? Don't you see what Jesus said? You're not doing it.
Darshan.
Didn't you hear what Jesus said? So Darshan now, you know, in our little subculture, in our shared vocabulary, Darshan is that hit you get, that very specific boom, boom, you know, that we associate with some sort of a download. You know, I mean, I think everybody has kind of their own personal definition for it. So, sure. You know, what you experienced and you didn't have this language for, you didn't have the words for it. And that's kind of cool to me, is that you can now take this word that you had and associate it with an experience you had a decade ago, which defined and changed the course of your life.
Absolutely.
Right. And you're like, well, that was Darshan. And I would say that was total. That was total Darshan. That's like beyond the beyond shit right there. Right. You know, so you were given that experience. And so we talk about, again, we can kind of go to the culmination We talk about the culmination and the beginning, right? I like that.
Yeah.
That's also in the Bible called the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. Didn't mean to do that. Just sort of worked its way into the conversation. So with Darshan, it can be life defining. It can be life changing. It obviously, you know, I've had my own experiences in those ways. And, you know, like I said, experiencing something like that in a Christian church when I was young, and then leading to a similar experience in dead shows, and then say leading to a similar experience, jamming out in the jungle in Hawaii with drummers and some, you know,
and it's
hallucinogens and, you know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. So you can experience Darshan looking at the stars, you know, you can experience Darshan sitting with your friends on the couch and laughing and having an experience that takes you out. We talk about be here now. So it doesn't take you out of the moment. It puts you in the moment.
It does. It sounds like it's a result of your karma. And I am bringing you back to this
karma,
the sum total of circumstances, inspirations, influences that you have carried with you in this and maybe past lifetimes to lead you to see things a certain way, to experience things a certain way, to set you up for that.
I would say that's your disposition, mm-hmm. something that you're born with, mm-hmm. something that I do believe we have inherent qualities at birth. Mm-hmm. There, we all have our own sort of makeup, right? And then the rest of us is put together by what happens to us in the world, especially those first 6 years, those formative years. So this idea of karma, whenever anyone says good karma, oh you got to do that for good karma, they immediately miss the freaking point. There's no such thing as good karma or bad karma. Mm. There's only karma.
It's all grist for the mill.
You can have things that happen to you that lead you in one direction or another, right? When we talk about karma in this way, karma is more like a blanket that's over everyone, right? We've got some pretty intense global karma going on.
We've got
super intense karma just over these United States because of what it took to build this land and the way what we've done with it since then, right? The blood in the soil, the karma of just this country, mm-hmm. right? So you can think about karma in those terms. If you think like, hey, I gave that bum $5, so now I'm due a free donut, then you're missing the freaking point,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, you're back to the sky puppet.
And that's not what, right, the sky, nice, I like that. You're back to the sky puppet. Exactly right, and that's not how it works. But I do like to think of how mysticism and spirituality aligns with science and physics even. And, you know, when I started to really kind of dig into this stuff, karma is whichever law of thermodynamics you push against something, it's physically pushing back. Mm-hmm. That's why you don't push your hand all the way through the wall, mm-hmm. because the wall is somehow pushing back. The force and the mass and all of that stuff is working against you. If you push hard enough and your mass and your inertia is greater than that of the wall, you can push through it, right? So if you think of karma, that karma is the pushback, right?
Good metaphor.
You like that?
Yeah, I do.
That work? And I don't know. I tell my friends all the time that they kind of, that's not what karma is. That's not how karma works. Friends tell their kids, like, if you do that, you'll get good karma. I'm like, no. Because honestly, all of our karma is totally already fucked. There is no good karma.
There are other ways to learn ethics, kids.
So then that brings us into concepts of service.
Yes.
Concepts of Leela, you know, concepts of God and deity and Darshan, like this whole idea that what we're doing is we're trying to burn off some of this karma, mm-hmm. these lifetimes. Mm-hmm. I love Hinduism. If you take it only as metaphor, I love it. I think that Hanuman is actually real and flies around on the earth doing good deeds for small children, but that's another story.
Different podcast.
Fairy tale Hanuman.
It sounds like you're talking about Seva.
Tooth fairy. Oh, Seva. I was talking about the tooth fairy Hanuman, but you bringing us back to Seva. All right. So All right. We've covered a little bit of God. And we've covered a little bit. What was it? Leela. Leela's great. Everything is a Leela, even this podcast.
We'll make it back to Leela.
Right?
I'm not worried.
So Darshan and now Seva. Mm-hmm. All right. So if we're talking, Seva is a, another word that people get wrong besides karma is yoga, right? Because we talk about... when people, most people, I think they're getting hipper.
I think so.
But
yeah.
When most people talk about yoga,
I hear asana thrown around.
They're
a lot
just
these
talking
days.
About the stretches.
Yes.
Right? Which is like 1/10 of it.
Not even.
If that.
Yeah.
Right? There's this whole attitude. There's this whole breathing. There's this whole conceptual understanding. But there are these other yogas, different sets of concepts and ideas. One of them is bhakti yoga. Mm-hmm. Which is what we practice at the ashram. And bhakti is just this devotional service aspect. Devotion is really all it means. We, those of us that sing, you know, we sing in front of this statue. At this point, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of this particular statue every single year. Mm-hmm. And getting bigger. There must
be
a reason
for it. The Shakti in that
room
is building and building and building.
The Shakti in that room is building and building and building. And there's got to be a reason. There's got to be a reason for that. So to talk about Seva, I want to talk about bhakti yoga, mm-hmm. that this service aspect or this devotional aspect. So Seva itself is this selfless service aspect, right? So to do when your Seva is the thing that you do in order to
to serve.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. And it's not about you, right? It's about the situation. Like, and similar, you can have darshan in other places. You can do seva. I mean, in the book, and in when I say the book, I mean Be Here Now. But Ram Dass, you know, he talked about chop wood and carry water. Mm-hmm. Be in the moment, right? The eternal, everlasting moment. This. You know, Dr. Joe Dispenza. Have you heard this? Joe Dispenza.
Tell me.
Really? He's the guy who apparently he rebuilt his own broken back with his mind. They told him he'd never walk
again.
Yes. Right? And he's got incredible things to say. But he talks about the eternal, ever-present, abundant moment. Right? Mm-hmm. Like the abundant moment. Like this is like every moment is the treasure of the universe.
Yes.
Right? So if you are doing seva, if you are truly doing seva, then you are in the moment of that service. You are, even Maharaji said, if you're doing this seva, it's not your energy. It's not even your own will anymore. The whole thing is working through you, right? So when you talk to people who are committed in this way, their work is their seva. It carries them. It does them, you know. They don't mm-hmm. do it. It does them. You know what I mean?
I'm glad that you've brought presence into it.
What do you mean?
Maybe this is where bhakti yoga and karma yoga kind of blend for me in this beautiful way. But anything that you do with full presence, full attention, full devotion is your seva.
Exactly right.
And I think I expected when I got to the ashram last week or whenever it was that my...
it was a year ago.
Yeah, I know.
You just totally lost time.
And we should talk about time. But I think I expected my seva to be just, you know, working in the kitchen or...
Did that show up?
Probably. I think I expected my seva to be working in the kitchen, maybe working in the garden. I expected it to be work, and it wasn't work at all. A lot of my seva has just been being fully present for the other people that are sharing this space with me, listening, you know, with an open mind and a deep heart.
That's a a great way to interpret it, like to save it doesn't necessarily always mean physical labor.
No.
But it often does in this particular situation because there's always 3 million dishes to do.
Yes, yes.
Right?
But and this, you know, the Capricorn in me has a complicated relationship with the word work. But I think, and this is where I'm going to bring in a little bit of my past experience, maybe working as a hospice companion. My ability, not even my ability, God's ability to be present with someone who maybe their physical capacity or their mental capacity is not what the same that we're used to experiencing in every relationship, but the ability to bring in this really mindful presence and share a space with someone is remarkable. And it surprises you. I've had some really far out conversations with folks who, you know, have experienced advanced Alzheimer's or dementia for a number of years. But those are the moments of deep love and learning for me. And that's been reflected here at the ashram. I think it was one of my first days here that you said to me that the ashram is the guru's body after the guru leaves his body. And taking care of my fellow sevaks, spending time with the caretakers, taking care of the grounds has been that act of presence for me.
So like you mentioned, for this particular guy, Neem Karoli Baba, as ashrams all over India, and when he was preparing to leave his body or knew he was going to be leaving his body, he told his devotees that when he left his physical form, then his ashrams would become his body. So in that way, he fulfilled the promise. He made a promise that he would come to the West. And this is, as far as we know, you know, the only way that he's actually come over to the West. Although there's all those stories about, you know, people see him. There's the great story about the Taos police officer having Maharaji's darshan and looking for him at the temple.
I don't know this story.
Well, we're going to do stories on another one. So remind me and I'll tell you, that one's fantastic. It's in a few books at this point. But we can talk about how we interpret that to mean, like what you just said, that your seva, your service is to the people that are there. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a specific job, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, your seva is also what you do in the world. The book talks about chop wood, carry water, mm-hmm. you know, so that's you make your life your seva. And the way you do that is you just dedicate all actions to God, in for lack of a better term.
You know, it's funny. I think that this concept of service, thinking of maybe like the ashram and the grounds and the work as the guru's body, it gets flipped in a funny way in Western culture. Where, you know, I think people are very over familiar with the phrase these days, like your body is a temple, you know, and that brings in the commercialization of self-care. But it's true. It's the first temple that we learn to take care of.
Mm.
You learn to brush your teeth, brush your hair, take care of your clothes. And it starts to tune you into these ideas of taking care, taking time. And I don't know. I guess this gets into the aspects of ritual for me.
Okay.
Because something becomes a ritual when you repeat it. And it carries meaning outside of any individual act of carrying out whatever that ritual is for
you.
Well,
and anything can be ritualized. Yeah. I think anything can be made into a sacred act. Anything can be ritualized. Anything can be made into seva, depending on the mindset. So.
Well, like you said, it's when the focus comes off of the self and onto something else, something greater.
Yes, I mean, yes, it's yes and yes and. Let's do a yes and with that, because
I love a yes and.
Well, there is the body that is doing the things, right? And yet the body does nothing. It's just sort of things are happening. I don't do, you know, when I'm making chai, I say I'm not making the chai. Maharaji's making the chai. Mm-hmm. And I'm not being a clown, and I'm not trying to do a thing and be like, no, really, Maharaji's making the chai. I can prove it to you because I can make it exactly the same way two times in a row and it will taste completely different, you know? Mm-hmm. And then in that way though, like I say, if I don't take the credit, I don't have to take the blame. If people don't like it, then I'm like, I didn't make it, Maharaji made it. But that backfired. There was some one day everybody was like, oh, the chai is great. And I said, I didn't make it. And they said, oh, you always say that. And I'm like, no, I really didn't make it. It was Gabriel made it. But you know, these, so kind of keeping in tune with these concepts of seva and, and devotional service. So to think of whatever it is you're doing with, like this podcast is seva. And, you know, if we've got that mindset around it, if we're doing it as a form of service, dedicating it to, you know, and to me, the easiest, the shortcut is just go straight to God. And we have that vehicle through Maharaji or, you know, depending on your own personal faith and belief system. But for us, we've got the Maharaji is the cheat code. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I can get messages to people faster by going through Maharaji than by trying to go through them. So the seva we do at the temple is sort of like hyper accelerated, right? Burning off lifetimes of karma for some reason. And you're also, you know, there's, it just kind of scenarios present themselves in the dish pit, right? Where you can connect with people or not, you know, maybe there's an issue that comes up and it's resolved or it isn't resolved, or maybe it's just beautiful connection with humans that you feel like you've known forever over the dish pit, right? You know, in the act of doing the seva, doing the service.
Even when you're working alone, I mean, I haven't been as much in the dish pit.
That's just the metaphor.
No, but I have been cooking. I've been in the kitchen quite a bit. It's come to everyone's attention that I like to make dessert. So that has been a large part of my
it's come, like you didn't say it out loud a bunch of thousand times. It's come to everyone's attention.
But no, it is. It's an act of service. And even when I'm working by myself, which is rarely, there's always somebody around that wants to help and is willing to help. But just the very simple act of presence, saying mantras or just carrying a happy and optimistic spirit, because the vibrations that you're emitting are going right into the food that is being shared by everyone there.
So let's talk about that. That's one of the words we wanted to discuss today, right? Prasad.
Prasad.
Which
I think just means consecrated food.
Well,
or is it greater? Like,
I mean,
can it cover other offerings?
Well, oh sure. I mean, like I said before, we've kind of, you know, we've westernized a lot of these terms. So, but prasad is the sacred offering. But, you know, we have baskets of photos that you give away. Those are prasad photos. And, if you know, sitting on the tucket on festival days, there'll be a basket of things, sometimes pictures, the magnets, the bags or prasad bags that we got this year that say sub ek on them.
So,
as far as the kind of the most basic concept and understanding of prasad, it's this idea of preparing something to be offered to a saint or a deity, to God, however you want to perceive that. And because of that, you can't take any enjoyment out of it. You can't eat it until it's been offered. So what that, like you were just saying, what that does is it creates a mindset, a mindfulness around the food. And if you're really doing it well, and if that's really your focus and what you're doing, then you're absolutely like shanti around the food. You're just very, it's all peaceful and it's all chill. Of course, being human beings, it doesn't always work out that way. But you know, you can, and you know, when the big Indian families come to prepare prasad for a Saturday or a Sunday or a festival, I mean, they are active.
Yes.
Very active, very loud, very boisterous.
It's wonderful to watch.
It's pretty cool. I wish I spoke, you know, Advali or
maybe you don't.
Or Hindi so that I can. No, I'm sure I do, because there's things I want to say to them about that guy over there. Like,
but even when people are bringing big energy and maybe something that can be interpreted as big negative energy into a space, people are frustrated or maybe they feel like they're running late or even, you know, gossip, things like that. What I've really learned from this experience is that it's its own kind of love. A lot of folks are very, very focused on perhaps mantra should be sung in the kitchen and perpetuating that idea. And so even when someone takes the time to correct you, that is an act of love. It might be rooted in a particular attachment to form, but that's someone who cares very deeply that something is done correctly, something is done with care.
We have to be very careful talking about attachment to form before we've even talked about the form. And right now, everything we're talking about is form.
Yeah.
Prasad is form. So it's, to me, it's not attachment to form. If you're engaging in doing the prasad, you're doing the prasad. Like, that's not an attachment to it. You're doing it. So the simplest example is making chai, because not only is it a constant there, but just to kind of define how it's done, you know, however you prepare the chai, if you use the Calcutta triple boil method in one pot, or if you do the... However you make it, to me,
next,
it's not...
Next, we're going to put out a cookbook.
It's not chai. I mean, it's chai. Chai just means tea anyway. So it's already chai. But what we were preparing in this way, preparing it as prasad. So when we're making the chai, I'm not taking enjoyment out of the ginger. It's very, when the spices hit the boiling water, there's a real rush. And it would be very easy to get taken in and enjoy it.
Oh, you caught me the other day.
Did I catch you, or did I just inform you? Right? Like, I mean, the very first thing that ever happened to me 24 years ago, and I come to this place before we had the mandir and you know, much smaller scene. I was there for Shivaratri, and I didn't know anything. And this may be getting into a story, and we're not doing stories, but I got yelled at for smelling flowers. And I didn't understand at the time, and nobody really explained it to me. They said, no, these are being offered, but they didn't tell me the significance of that. They didn't tell me what that meant. So as a young, you know, hippie, I was like, there was this one thing about, like, this is why I don't like these kinds of places. You know what I mean? Like, this is why I don't do this, because there's so much judgment and dogma. And dogma. I wouldn't have had the language for it at the time, but let's say attachment to form. However, what it's being done is those flowers are being prepared into malas that are then offered to all of the deities that we have represented around the ashram. And as soon as any time, so what we're doing is, we're basically, to me, I consider it holding space. We're holding that space. We're keeping our own senses out of the game for the preparation of, and it actually creates the mindset. So if you've been, did you do any mala tying or any mala making this year?
I did.
Isn't
that a
vibe? That a vibe?
Absolutely.
Every
magical
time. Because if you're making the malas, you're definitely not overindulging in gossip or going too deep down some of these roads, right? Mm-hmm. You're keeping it pretty shanti. So, you know, that is a type of prasad. And that's, once it's offered, you can smell the flowers all you want. So with the chai, you prepare your spices, you heat up your milk. You have your spice side and your milk, and then when everything's ready, you blend it all together, sweeten the thing up. But you have to take a little cup for Maharaji, right? Mm-hmm. So at this point, you still, like, it's becoming beautiful. You know, the combination of the colors and the what's happening in the pot is very easy to get, like, again, seduced by your senses. You got to hold on just that one more second, and you go and get one of Maharaji's own special cups. You pour a little bit into it, you take it to a picture, you go around the kitchen, ring a bell, Shri Shri Shri, Akasara Babanim Kuroli. And then everybody, if anybody's around, they all say, Kijay! And it's a great
very
thing.
Very joyous.
Yeah, and then you go and you dump it. And usually, by then, there's a line of people who are ravenous and ready for Maharaji's chai. So at that moment, as soon as the cup goes back in there, then
it's
boom,
to be shared. It,
well, then it's prasad.
Yes.
So then it's been consecrated. Then you can enjoy the spices all you want. You can enjoy the flavors. And it's not to say, you know, so, and I could see why people would, especially the Western mind, is not necessarily okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, can you...
But you can conceptualize it. I liked that you said becoming beautiful. I've been thinking about that a lot in my seva today. I've been reorganizing a bookshelf. And it's such a great metaphor for self.
You're reorganizing your book self.
Oh, it was positively magical. You know, you start, you pull everything off, all of the crap that you've collected. It's all mishmashed. It doesn't mean anything. It's just, you know, a wonderful mixture. And you start to sort through it a little bit. You start to process it. You're wiping out the cobwebs.
Did you come up with this while you're doing it, or is this just on the fly in the moment?
This was occurring to me. I spent a long time on this bookshelf today. Cleaning out the cobwebs, you know, getting the dust out. And then you start putting things back. You start organizing them. You start linking things and experiences together. You see what fits. Maybe you find a few books with some broken spines, some torn pages. You let those go. And once you've recreated the space, you start to make it beautiful.
So you know that the ashram is like 1,000,000% the opposite of that. Right? You're talking about a very analytical, planned out, this is how this happens, and I'm taking this, and I mean, come on. You haven't fucking done that yet. Sorry.
No, but
it's a great metaphor, but let's stick with this magic trip. Like what I'm saying is the ashram is not that analytical. It's not that you can process things, but it's the experiences that are happening to you in the moment. So we talked about Leela. These are how this particular guru, this is how this teacher has often said that he didn't have a specific teaching. We've distilled it to love, serve, remember, you know, love everyone, feed everyone, remember God. But at this point, like, it's pretty much considered that the Leelas are the sort of, he would put these circumstances together, and this is where the Leela stuff comes into play, and the circumstances would be where the teaching comes from, the circumstances, you know. So if you, so let's say, for example, you are, let's use all the words, you're getting into some seva at the dish sink and somebody comes up and offers you a Leela. Sorry, none of that's correct. But honestly, like, yeah, say it's a big festival day and you're at the dish sink and in the process of doing that seva, you know, other things are kind of happening. Other things are coming through. Other transmissions are coming through. Maybe you're alone and you're starting to have realizations about yourself. You can hear the music. Mm-hmm. The music is getting you, let's say. But, you know, however it works, it's through these actions and through this movement and being active and doing things that the Leelas kind of come up. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of us, when we found ourselves here, found ourselves on this path, because like I said, for me, it wasn't an analytical thought out thing. I had to almost die just to be like clear enough to be able to see it and understand it and receive anything from it. You know, so that's like the big Leela that sort of, mm-hmm. that brought me there. But for a lot of people, it's been similar. It's been a set of wacky circumstances, like one on top of another, perhaps for years and years, that led to some awareness of this place or some knowledge of the actual ashram here in Taos, you know, and then going there, physically going to the place. And then, you know, that's where the Leelas kind of start to kick in. And it's not for everybody. I came to this place a couple of times before I was a devotee. You know, but even those couple of times coming, it was working in me. And that's why I was coming. I had no idea that I was going to be a lifelong devotee of a guru wrapped up in a blanket. Looks like somebody's weird uncle, you know, but here we are. So the Leelas, you know, I can attest personally to how this is kind of, how this has worked itself out. So you wanted to talk about, I think we can talk about another word. If you want to.
Well, it's funny, you know, you get a little wackadoo with your Leelas and everything. And
I don't. Maharaji does. Those aren't my Leelas.
There's a transient nature to it. I think for me, like I said, yeah, that the ritual, the repetition, the contemplation aspect of it is really, really strong. I think it's called Jhana Yoga, maybe. I don't know. Jhana. Okay.
Of
thank
the mind.
You. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes. And really my first spiritual language is Buddhism.
Anya.
So there is this aspect of contemplation, of repetition to me that really connects me to the message. Cause I, maybe I'm just not that smart and I don't get it the first time.
Well, there's a reason why it's called a practice.
Yes, yes. But so for me, coming to Artsy twice a day has been really, really meaningful. I've missed a few, let's be real. I'm here recording now.
I don't even go to Artsy twice a day. That's but awesome. I love Artsy.
Like I said, that sort of cyclical nature of coming back to something and seeing where you are each time and looking at that on a broader timeline is really important to me. And this is where we should probably define Artsy a little.
I was just going to say, let me ask you, and this will be, we'll wrap this soon. Mm-hmm. But what does Artsy mean to you? And I'm not looking for a textbook Google dictionary definition. Like, what does it mean to you in simple, kind of simple terms, if you can?
Artsy is when they blow the conch shell in the morning at 7 a.m. and I rush to the mandir and we sing several prayers in Hindi and I try my best to follow along with the transliteration.
They're not in Hindi. Maybe I think one of them might be in Hindi. They're in Adwali in Sanskrit.
Of course, yes. a language that I don't read.
Right.
And there have been times where I'm really wrapped up in trying to follow these things. You know, I don't have any of the chalisas, the Hanuman chalisa, or any of them memorized at this point. Mm-hmm. Not sure that's going to happen for me on this trip. Mm-hmm. But there are moments where, and this may, you know, gets back into the spontaneity of it, where I get caught in the music, in the energy of the room, in the rhythm of the room.
Yes.
And that is a moment where God flows through.
It's kind of cool that a bunch of reformed Westerners, you know, a lot of us have Christian upbringing, Catholic upbringing, you know, and a lot of us kind of revolted against that. I know I did. So to me, it's interesting that I love to sing these prayers, but I've talked to people who are atheists or anti-theists who say that it's all just different versions of the same hooey, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter. And then, so I kind of take that to a universalist perspective. Then it's like, okay, then it doesn't matter. If you have a heart of devotion and if you are approaching, and for a lot of us, it just works better. It doesn't have all the baggage. Mm-hmm. I know Hindu people that don't practice Hinduism because they've got their own baggage with it, you know, so I can kind of relate to that in that way. But for us, I guess maybe that's part of it. We don't have the same level of attachment to the baggage part, so we can engage in these practices in a way that and it's also possible that these particular practices transcend some things that other practices don't. You know, I'm not saying that it's better or worse.
You're searching for God in a language that is comfortable with you.
It was not. And if you watch people's faces when they're trying to read the prayers, they don't look very comfortable at all. And it took me studying it. Like, you don't just learn the chalisa. You don't just wake up one day and you have the chalisa. I'm sure there's a few people that have that miracle. Because I know people have been coming to this place for 40 years that don't know the chalisa.
There was a small part of me that was hoping for that miracle as well.
No, you got to sit down and dig into it.
Yeah.
And when you do.
Repetition.
When you do. So we can, let's take the last couple minutes to talk about chalisa aspect and how it relates to Artsy and Seva. And so, yes, the Artsy literally means the light. So it's what we're offering is the flame. Mm-hmm. So the real thing is the flame. And then you offer to your deity or saint, or if you have a Murti like we do that you want to honor, you're offering incense, water, food. So the food that's always in front of Maharaji and Hanuman, that's always prasad.
Yeah.
The water, there's water cups in front of everyone.
I'm learning so much on this podcast. I already should have known.
That was the point. That's what we were wanting to do.
I love that you can take the prasad off of the altars here too. You know, I mean, of course, once it's been offered and things like that, like there's the sharing aspect I really appreciate.
Yes. And that's just kind of, you know, it's sort of like the vibe is distributed in the food, right? And if you think about it, and this can kind of appeal to like the sort of the hippie side of me. And I was really into crystals. Really into crystal magic and really into working with energy with crystals. And
I can see that. Sure.
You could definitely read. You mean that you can see that in me?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty on brand. And you develop a sensitivity to what's going on. And I thought, well, if I'm hanging out and meditating on these crystals that have been forming in the earth and I feel like they can resonate a vibration back to me, well, this alabaster or marble statue that has been loved and adored and sung to day in and day out for 40 years now. Why can't that absorb this thing? And then you start to, there's words for it.
Hinduism, I love that.
Hinduism is set up for it. So there's words. It's not just a concept like, oh, I wonder what that's like. No, there's words for it. And that's kind of what we have been trying to do here today, is talk a little bit about these words and how they relate to us as individuals, and how they relate to what we're doing at this lovely spot here in Taos. And I would like to thank our producer, Mootown. Thank you so much for your time and your space. I would like to thank
and
you.
And your patience.
Yes, especially your patience. And I'd like to thank you, Deki, for engaging in this journey with me.
Likewise, Ananda. I appreciate the invitation to be here.
We're going to do some more, and we're going to kind of dig in deeper to some of these concepts. So thank you all for listening. My name is Baba Ananda.
And Deki. This has been the Searching for Godcast.
See you next time.
See you next time.